Scobishaw, how are you?
Good morning, judges. I have to thank Mr. McCracken because I've never done this before and I got a chance to see how it's done.
And you see that we are not, we are only interested in asking questions that will help us make a decision.
I'll do my best, Your Honor.
Okay.
I'll do my best.
Thank you, Mr. You're welcome. I'm glad you're here.
It's my understanding I have 10 minutes, correct?
You have a total of 15 minutes.
Okay.
And if you want to reserve any time to rebut the Commonwealth's argument, you can reserve as much of that or as little. Well, it's 5 minutes, 10 minutes, but you have 15 minutes. You can use it all at first or reserve any number of those minutes for rebuttal. So our question is always, how much would you like to reserve of your 15 minutes for rebuttal time? You don't have to rebut if you don't think it's necessary.
I did this last night, Your Honor. My presentation took 7 minutes.
So. Okay. So if you want to reserve, why don't we reserve 5 minutes, 10 minutes?
I think 5 minutes probably should do it.
It's yours, and if you will look at the lights beside you, when you start arguing, the green light will come on. When you get to the 10-minute mark, the yellow light will come on. You can keep talking if you'd like, but when the red light comes on, you got to stop.
That's it.
Okay?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
The trap door is jammed.
So if you want to proceed with your argument, we'd be delighted to hear it.
Your Honors, this hinges on two sentences given to Mr. McLeese, my client. The first sentence on August 26, 2013. And that sentence was, the court sentences the defendant to the State Department of Juvenile Justice. The court suspends the State Department of Juvenile Justice commitment. Then, about 53 days later, the court resentenced Mr. McLeese to incarceration in the Virginia Department of Corrections for the term of 5 years, total sentence imposed, 5 years. The court suspends 5 years of the sentence, total suspension, 5 years. It's not that big of a deal, but at the time it was, because Mr. McLeese was facing an upcoming jury trial at this time. Given that second sentence, being sentenced as an adult, had he lost that subsequent jury trial, he would have been facing some mandatory time. So we thought there were some problems with how this was done, and we appealed it. Now, the subsequent trial turns out that he was completely acquitted of the other charges he had, which made this particular issue a little less important, but right is right and wrong is wrong. And we have proceeded onward.
Mr. So the reason it's not moot is because being treated as an adult has collateral consequences?
Yes, sir. Absolutely. For any subsequent criminal proceedings, it does. Mr. McLeese,
Let me ask you this.
Yes, sir.
How old is your client?
He just turned 18.
Okay. So in other words, it's not like he's past the 21 years and he's going to be treated as an adult no matter what.
From now on, he will be. Yes, sir.
Well, right. But, I mean, you know, you reach a point where it doesn't matter whether you committed. I mean, there's certain things that you're just no longer going to be treated as a juvenile once you reach a certain age.
That's true, Your Honor.
Okay. All right.
Mr. McLeese contends that the trial court on August 26, 2003, sentenced him to a perfectly legal sentence. And then 53 days later, via written order, changed its mind and sentenced him to a harsher sentence. Among other issues, we contend that action conflicts with 19.2-303. I'll come back to that if the court wants me to. Regarding the merits of the case, the first sentencing event versus the second sentencing event, the merits of this case hinge on the word may and shall in 16.1272A1. On August 26th, Mr. McLeese, the Commonwealth and the sentencing judge, we contend all relied on the word may in 16.1272A1. The sentencing judge could have sentenced Mr. McLeese as she did 53 days later, but she didn't on August 26th. The judge believed on that original sentencing date, as did the Commonwealth and the defendant, that the word may allowed her discretion to sentence Mr. McLeese to the sentence she sentenced him to, period. 21 days later, the Commonwealth decides, for their very own reasons, and we have contended in our briefs that they cited Saunders versus Commonwealth, which Judge McCullough, that's what you were asking about. It's a harsher sentence, so subsequent trials make his, if he was found guilty, makes his sentence more harsh. 21 days later, they decide that may really means shall, And that doesn't give the judge any discretion except the three options listed in 16.1272A1. That Mr. McLeese must be sentenced according to one of those three options listed, completely ignoring settled law like Brown versus Commonwealth, 279 Virginia 210, 2010, which states clearly in regard to 16.1272A1, this section, quote, gives a circuit court the discretion to sentence a juvenile tried as an adult to a juvenile disposition rather than sentencing the judge as an adult, close quote. Can it be any clearer? And Mr. McLeese, the Commonwealth, and the sentencing judge, on the original date, all agreed with that, and she sentenced him as a juvenile. So on the 21st
even
day...
Even if the trial court can do what you say it can do, mm-hmm. does a trial court have to do that? In other words,
no, sir.
Suppose the court had given him a year. I mean, it seems like the court can revisit the sentence, assuming it's within the right time frame. Court can revisit the sentence and make it more lenient or more harsh within its discretion.
Actually, Your Honor, under 19.2303, if a person has been sentenced for a felony to the Department of Corrections but has not actually been transferred to a receiving unit of the department, and Mr. McLeese wasn't, the court which heard the case, if it appears compatible with the public interest and there are circumstances in mitigation of the offense, may at any time before the person is transferred to the department suspend or otherwise modify the unserved portion of such sentence. They can make it lighter, Your Honor, but
that the point of that statute is we have this harsh 21-day rule in Virginia. Court can do anything within those 21 days. I mean, a court could come back and say, you know what, I should have acquitted him. I'm going to revisit my order.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, the court can't go the other way on that.
Right.
But on sentencing, the court has discretion. I don't see anything that would forbid a court, provided it acts within that 21-day time frame, to say, you know, I didn't realize what a bad actor he was, and I'm going to make it harsher. But 303 allows, after the 21 days, for the court to come in. That's the point of that statute. Is to make the sentence less harsh once that otherwise permissible time frame has elapsed.
And 303 really only applies to adult incarceration because of DOC, the reference to Department of Corrections.
And the second time he was sentenced as an adult.
Second time.
Right. On the 21st day after the original sentencing date, the Commonwealth almost convinces the judge to vacate the original sentence. Unfortunately for the Commonwealth, under Rule 1:1 of the Rules of the Virginia Supreme Court, in cases like Berry and Law Group, PC versus Cox, 259 Virginia 622-2000, and I can read the pertinent passages if the court wishes, a court speaks through its written orders, and no written order of any
kind. So that's the problem in this case, is the court waits too long. So then the question becomes, in my mind, was this original order void or voidable? If it's void, you can collaterally attack it at any time. It's legal nullity. Come back 10 years later and knock it out, whatever. If it's only voidable, then you have to challenge it within the requisite time period. And if it's not challenged, then the fact that there was legal error is irrelevant, and that becomes the final order. So if it is a voidable as opposed to a void order, you still win, not on the statutory grounds that you raise, but on the fact that the court didn't modify or vacate or suspend its order within the 21 days.
Be written order. Void judgment. A void judgment is one that has been procured by extrinsic or collateral fraud or entered by a court that did not have jurisdiction over the subject matter of the parties. Rook v. Rook, 233 Virginia 92, 353, 1987. We can all agree, Your Honors, that the court certainly has subject matter jurisdiction over the criminal case. I think we can also all agree that nobody perpetrated a fraud on the court, neither the Commonwealth or the defense or
except
the judge.
Except we're somewhat arguing that the Commonwealth committed a fraud on the court by violating a plea agreement.
We didn't like that, Your Honor, but I agree with the justice that it's the time when the written order was finally put out. That did make me very angry, Your Honor. We weren't expecting that.
We noticed that.
Yeah.
Made you angry.
And so, Your Honor, it's not the two main reasons to make something void is subject matter jurisdiction or a perpetrating a fraud, and that neither of that happened. The judge made the decision that the judge made on that 21st day. But all she said, and I have copies of the page 14 and 15 of the transcript.
The court just continued the case.
If the court would say, I'm going to do this, but she didn't. And she also allowed me to brief it, which we can conclude then that the final decision hadn't been made. Else why she asked me to brief it. We get there on that day, and then the following day on October 18th, for the first time, a written order appears vacating the August 26th sentence. It's the contention of the appellate here that it was not done correctly, and the only really void order, which fits perfectly into the definition of void, is the October 18th order. Because guess what? The court had lost subject matter jurisdiction at that point. And we're asking the court to nullify that second order, which would reinstate the first order. And I think I have 19 seconds left, and if the court is satisfied with me, I'll yield.
Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Whitman.
Good morning, Judge Felton, and may it please the court. Stephen Whitmer here on behalf of the Commonwealth today. Let me begin by addressing the issue that the court requested us by email to address, which is the applicability of Rule 1:1 and whether the 21-day rule affects the validity of the second order. I would suggest that the court in this matter has to be guided by the line of cases following Rawls versus Commonwealth in 278 Virginia, including this court's recent decision in July in Commonwealth versus Ray Sean Greer, which recognized the principle that an order that does not impose a sentence that is required by statute is void ab initio. In that case, the original sentencing order is void ab initio, a nullity and not a proper final order, and that is what gave the court continuing jurisdiction.
Counsel, let me ask you this. In Rawls and in Greer, the principle was that it was either below the sentencing guidelines or sentencing parameters or above it. In this instance, it's neither. It's more a question of quantitative versus qualitative. Would this court be extending the principles in Rawls and Greer if we were to find that it was voidable, or that it was void? I'm sorry.
I think the court in Rawls and Greer, the courts were addressing situations in which the sentencing range was at issue. However, the language of the opinions pretty clearly already embraces a sentence that is not authorized by statute. And our position today is that the original sentence suspended to the Department of Juvenile Justice did not comply with the statute and thus was improper. And the trial court was well within its rights to take the matter up again and to correct the order. I would concede also that in the event that this court determines that Rawls and the reasoning there do not save this case, then there would have been no jurisdiction to enter the second sentencing order.
And my concern is there's all these things that you have to do at sentencing. You're supposed to order a pre-sentence report. We just had the decision from the Supreme Court of Virginia about certain probation conditions and what a court can and can't do. And if we open this can of worms or where something is going to be void, that invites a whole lot of problems for the Commonwealth and for everybody else. And that's my concern.
Judge McCullough, let me say that I think there has been some confusion from the courts in the past decade over the where void and voidable lie, and
I'm not going to dispute that.
And I will say that my understanding prior to Rawls was that, you know, if the court lacked subject matter jurisdiction, that was the key to voidness, as opposed to an order being voidable. Rawls seems to backtrack somewhat from that principle, and the use of the language void ab initio is explicit. And for better or worse, the Commonwealth would submit the court is bound by that, and if the Supreme Court wishes to revisit the issue, they should do so. If they feel that
I agree with you that Rawls is in some tension with what the court has said in the past about what is void ab initio. Question is, do you cabin that somehow logically to avoid opening this can of worms that I'm worried about? Maybe we can do that, maybe we can't.
And let me go back to my point about, you know, Greer is the logical extension of Rawls from one extreme to the other extreme. But the question becomes then, do we take it to that quantitative versus qualitative analysis? Help us, Mr. Weber.
Judge McCullough, Judge Decker, I think the Supreme Court has opened that can of worms for us.
So you think Rawls is broad enough to...
I do, Your Honor. I really do. I think it's not just limited to the duration of sentence. It is not by its terms limited, so it refers to a sentence not authorized by statute.
And fix their own.
I don't mean to encourage a further appeal of this matter, but I think that court is where the fix lies. With respect to the other matters that have been raised, the allegation that the Commonwealth, for some strategic reason, was attempting to hook Mr. McLeese into being tried as an adult is entirely without support in the record. He admitted on the record he knew he was being tried as an adult. He admitted on the record he knew that he could be sentenced to up to life in prison, which would be inconsistent with statute if he was...
Plea agreement, what he got out of it was charges dropped, and then it was entirely up to the court to figure out an appropriate sentence. So I don't understand the breach of a plea agreement unless there was some unwritten or implicit understanding that's not on the record.
It appears to simply be a situation in which the parties prior to the sentencing hearing did not read closely the statute in the manner in which perhaps they should have. But once the statute's looked
at... And it's the juvenile code and it's confusing.
This is perhaps the deepest I have delved into the juvenile code. Perhaps if I get closer to the deeper end, I may need to improve my swimming skills. but we're sort of in the shallow end here. The statute appeared to have been not authorized in the sense that a suspended sentence for a juvenile violent felony to the Department of Juvenile Justice was not authorized. For that reason, the court acted properly in correcting an order that was void ab initio and imposing a lawful sentence upon the defendant. For those reasons, we would ask the court to affirm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Counsel, let me ask you one question. Opposing counsel relies on Brown of the Commonwealth. What's your take on Brown in terms of for the substantive argument?
I think it's, you know, the question really is, I think, you know, different parts of Brown support the party's cases. When you're dealing with a violent juvenile felony, it's pretty clear that the sentencing has to be under 16.1272A1. And I think that's the answer to that question.
Thank you.
Briefly, Your Honors, obviously there's two different interpretations of 16.1272A1, and we still stand by our interpretation. The court had great discretion being in compliance with Brown v. Commonwealth. I will take my last few minutes, Your Honors, to cite four cases if the court will allow me. It is not sufficient for the trial judge merely to express a desire to consider action or take the issue under advisement. Rather, the trial judge must issue an order modifying, vacating, or suspending the sentence.
Right, but then your opposing counsel pointed out this line of cases that if a court enters an order, and that folds back into the statutory argument, but if the court enters an order that has no power to enter, and therefore the sentencing order is void under this Rawls and Greer line of cases, well then the court was entirely within its prerogative to enter the second sentencing order.
Once again, Your Honor, I would stand by the interpretation of void as being not having a subject matter jurisdiction or fraud perpetrated on the court.
Right, those are civil cases, and that's the general rule, but we seem to have gotten ourselves into this weird little cove outside the flow of that jurisprudence, and we're trying to figure out if there's a way to make sense of it.
And all I can offer the court is already settled law that that doesn't do Rawls and Greer. I understand what the court was
saying.
Counsel,
talk to us about Rawls.
Can't, Your Honor. I'm not that familiar with the case. Okay. I wish I could. I have Berrien Law Group PC versus Cox, which says the running of time may be interpreted only by the entry, then the 21-day period after final judgment or the order suspending or vacating, and the trial court must enter an order that expressly modifies, vacates, or suspends the judgment.
The bottom line with Rawls was that it was a court, there's a maximum that the court could have sentenced the defendant to, and the court by mistake went above that. So then the question was, is that void, or is that just a legal error that should have been timely appealed? And the Supreme Court indicated that that was void. And so then the problem is, as you point out, well, the court had subject matter jurisdiction, had jurisdiction over the parties. And so why was that void as opposed to voidable? But that's what the court said. And so that was in the specific context of a sentencing order. And so we're trying to figure out what to make of that. That's our dilemma.
Your Honor, in closing, all I can close is this, Your Honor. There's no question in the minds of the appellant that the second order, the court did not have subject matter jurisdiction on October 18th, clearly. And if there's going to be a void order, that would be the order that would be void by anyone's yardstick. And I thank you for the time you've given me, and this wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be.
We're going to thank you for your argument. Is it Cogshaw?
Cogshaw.
Cogshaw. Yes. We're going to come down and greet you personally and thank you for your argument as well as for Mr. Whitmer. And then we're going to take up the case of Orthopedic Spine Center versus Keystone Automotive, Mr. Spivey and Ms. Elk.